Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks.
Hi, how's it going?
Nice to meet you virtually.
Nice to meet you as well.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, me too. So how this is going to work is we wrote a summary. I don't know if you saw the questions and stuff I sent over.
I did.
Okay, cool.
I did. I actually did look at it.
Oh,
so
amazing.
And I reread the paper so I remember what it's about. So
Perfect.
That's how you know when you're a big shot is when you have to reread your own paper.
What did I write?
Yeah.
What did
That's
I
definitely
publish?
What it is. You know, that means that I spend too much time not doing papers and forget everything. So
yeah.
That's the truth of it. It has nothing to do with paper volume or quality. It has to do with all the other crap, like postdocs coming in and interrupting you all the time.
It's a terrible life when Alex McIntyre is your postdoc, you know?
I know. Honestly, it's hard. It's hard to deal with every day.
But if you want, we can just make this podcast like a vent session.
Instead. Yeah, it can be.
Oh, that'd be great.
Like a
shark therapy.
Yeah, impromptu therapy session, you know?
Oh my gosh.
What is it really like?
I don't know if that's the podcast you want to make.
Wait, I'm sorry. Look at his name says Alex's boss.
It does.
I didn't see that until just now. Is that like your most proud thing? Is that you're Alex McIntyre's boss?
It's my only claim to fame. It's like everybody knows Alex McIntyre.
It's true. Everyone does know her.
And if they don't, they do want to. That's why I am doing everything I can to never let her go anywhere else. So
that's a good plan.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have some control over that, right? Like, I am her supervisor, and I will write her the worst recommendation letters ever.
So. Perfect.
That's ethical, right?
It's okay.
Great.
I definitely got that on recording. All right.
I tell her that. She knows it. Okay.
Down to business. This has been the most, like, bunny trail podcast interview we've done thus far. Okay. Welcome to Sharkpedia, everybody. I'm somehow going to get us on track to start this podcast because we have been chatting up a storm. But today we have Dr. Taylor Chappell here with us. Dr. Chappell wrote a paper called Ancillary Data from Animal-Borne Cameras as an Ecological Survey Tool for Marine Communities back in 2021. This is such a cool paper, and we're really excited to have you. So thank you so much for being here, Dr. Chappell.
Thanks. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and what got you into this field?
Yeah. How much time do we have? I sort of started out my career as a population modeler. I got into shark science in the end of my undergraduate career. I had no expectations I was going to go into sharks at all, but kind of got keyed into this question about predator-prey interactions while I was an undergrad. And the system that seemed like a cool place to do that had a lot of scope with sharks. And so that's how I got involved. But I really was looking at it from a modeling perspective. Where are the populations at in terms of their numbers? What are the trajectories? And over time, that's morphed. And I like to talk about that because I think we have this expectation that folks that are in a career, like that's what they wanted to do. And that's where they are now because they followed that career path forever. And what are the steps to get there? And it turns out that like the steps to get here, at least for me, were all over the place. Like I staggered all over the place on the way to get here. And that's okay. And so so now I work mostly in sort of the movement and the behavior, and as we'll, you know, talk about today, how we use some of these other technologies to understand sort of the fine scale movements and behaviors of these animals. And then what else can we do with those data? So now that we've got a bunch of videos for sharks, I don't want to like spoil this at all, but what do we do with that video that we have from sharks? And is that all we can do with it? Or do we have to think outside the box? So, you know, I'm constantly evolving what I do. And that's what, you know, that's what this field is. It's just evolving what you're interested in.
Yeah, that is so true, and a very perfect segue right into our summary for your article. So I will jump straight into that, which is what you're talking about is these videos you're taking after putting cameras on sharks, and what you do with that video afterwards. So the summary of this paper is as follows. Underwater visual surveys, such as diver-based video surveys, are a common and essential technique in measuring and managing marine ecosystems. However, there are several limitations to doing such surveys, such as recreational diving depth limits or animal interactions that preclude safe diving, such as white shark-sea lion interactions. Biologging camera tag devices are commonly used to study a single focal species behavior. However, ecosystem-wide data is collected and could be used to monitor and assess habitats that may not be accessible to humans. In this study, Chapel et al. Use a video camera logger on white sharks in Gardens Bay, South Africa, and a gray reef shark within the Chagos Archipelago to determine if video logging could be used to measure habitat structure of their respective environments. They used established methods to analyze video data and found that the biologging from the sharks was relatively comparable. So using biologgers such as the ones used in this study could maximize the overall cost and effort of tagging deployments by gathering more ecosystem-wide data than just the focal species data. So I thought, to be honest with you, this is like one of the first times I actually heard of this. I think we collect a lot of data. I think about this a lot in the field. I'm constantly collecting so much data. And I'm not going to use all of it. And how do we maximize that effort? So I thought this was such an interesting thing that you did where you already had all this video from sharks being tagged and you thought, what else can we use with this video? What else can we learn about the environment? So can you touch on diver-based surveys using video systems and how using what are the challenges in using human-based video logging and why are animal-borne cameras more cost-effective or useful in this context?
Sure. Yeah. So I guess I'll step that back maybe one pace and to think more about sort of the impetus for using these data generally outside of the focal species. So I think recently there's been sort of this push to paraphrase some other scientists to collect once and use many times. And so this idea that, you know, we're going into the environment and we're expending resources, right? It costs money, it costs gas, it costs time. And there's a cost to the animals, you know, however you want to hash it out, catching an animal or equipping an animal or sampling an animal, or sometimes even going out to observe an animal has an effect. And so there is a responsibility for us as stewards of the natural world to limit the effect that we have. So we can do science by going out into the environment and collecting data, but what we also need to be thinking about is how do we utilize the data that maybe we've already collected or someone else has collected already so that we don't have to go manipulate those animals. We don't have to go exert those resources. And so that's part of the impetus of where this research started. And so, you know, putting cameras on the back of a white shark or a reef shark, we had a specific question in mind. It was like, all right, what is this, you know, what is this animal doing in its day-to-day? How is it interacting with its environment? But there's a lot of other information that's collected at that same time. You know, the idea that a picture's worth 1,000 words, like there's a lot going on there. So that was sort of the first step in this. And then to get more to your question about like, well, what's the difference between an animal doing it and a person doing it is, well, first off, you know, you can save some of those resources. So we don't have to put a person in the water to do those surveys. We don't have to have divers that are trained to go down. You know, you put a sharks already know how to swim. So all you need to do is attach something to them that's going to collect those data for you. There's also limits in terms of cost. And so the work that we do in the Chagos Archipelago, you know, it's thousands of miles from the nearest port. And you're out for weeks at a time. And you've got, not only do you have a vessel that is supporting those missions, but you have a team of scientists. So you've got maybe 10 or 15 scientists that are on board that boat. So you think about the resources just in terms of time and money that go into collecting those data. It's pretty significant. So if instead you can pare that down and you've got a small boat and you have a couple scientists or a scientist or a couple sort of lay people that are out putting these tags on the animals, then they're doing all that work for you. So it limits not only your sort of impact in terms of your environmental impact from fuel, from flying people in all over the world to this spot, as well as the impact sort of in those communities, because you're not dropping 10 divers down in the water to survey those reefs. You're going to affect that one shark that's going to be swimming around collecting data for you. Another aspect is that we're, as much as we like to think that we're, you know, sort of, it can be in a water system and feel natural, is that we don't belong there. And so the sharks do. And so when you put a diver in the water with, whether it's a rebreather or a regular scuba system, like, they're going to cause some fish and some animals to behave differently. So by putting a shark in the water or some other animal with a camera on it, that animal naturally lives in that environment. So you're getting a lot more natural distributions or natural behaviors of those animals around. So there's a lot of different effects that you can have by sort of swapping out the person side and having an animal do the work for you. And I will talk forever. So
yeah. Monty and I are like, we have more questions.
I have questions. So I can take this out of the podcast if this is like a thing that you don't want to be put out into the world, but I'm wondering if you can give me a number on how much it costs to do something like this with all of the people versus if you just use the animal-borne cameras.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, to do something like the Chagos trip to the Chagos Archipelago, whether you're doing it with diver-based surveys or animal-based surveys, you still need to get there. There still is some cost, but it's orders of magnitude less. So you think about just a big research vessel that can support dive operations, that can support the number of divers that you need to have on board, plus you have safety officers, plus you have a crew for that, you fly all this in. You're talking about just the vessel itself is going to be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then you take people's times, you take the flights, you take all of that in, you know, you're up over $1 million. And you can collect multiple data sources during those trips, right? So when we're doing dive surveys, that's not the only thing happening. We're also doing bird surveys. We're doing other things. So you can combine these things. But there's a fundamental cost that is, you know, orders of magnitude larger when you're trying to get people in the water in these remote places. It's also really risky and dangerous. You know, so we're at that spot, you're, you know, well, we were there when the pandemic hit. And it took me from the moment we got the call to turn around, that Australia was closing their borders, and some of our team was from Australia. It took me a week to get back. So these are really remote places. And so when you're diving, there's inherent risks. We're limited to 30 meters on these dives, or actually less than 30 meters. So the idea that we could collect those data without putting as many people at risk is also one of those I think parameters that are really hard to justify in terms of numbers, but is really important in terms of people.
So why the heck aren't more people doing this?
I think the reason is because it's not on everybody's radar yet. And there are caveats to having animals collect your data. And the communication between the people that have the data and the people that might want to use the data may not be strong enough yet. I think the reason that we were able to turn these video data into something comparative was that I was on these trips with an awesome group of researchers from the UK and from Australia that were looking at reefs. They were, you know, they do underwater surveys of kelp distributions and things like that. So I was on the boat and was like, oh, hey, we've got these data. Can we do something else with them? They're right there, right? But I wasn't sending an email out to the entire reef community and say, hey, does anybody want this video? That's the type of thing that may need to happen and say that, all right, well, you know, where is this repository of video data that we have and who else wants to use it? You know, something that actually connects communities that aren't necessarily having those conversations is probably what needs to happen to make it more, more feasible and more common.
Yeah, this is really interesting. It's making me think of, for my work, I use CT scans and do a lot of scanning, and we have a website that we all collectively upload our scans to for people to just be able to download and use, which is definitely like a massive database and needs a large place for storage. But it seems like more things like that in other disciplines would also be really beneficial, which is exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And the thing about that, though, is that it's a hard sell, right? So you've got, so take this Chagos trip, for example. We've got, you know, maybe $1 million invested in all the cost of making that happen, and we get some data points. We post that, we put that up in this used data system, and then someone else can come in and use that. They haven't contributed at all to that process. And it's been years and years for us to get funding, to get permits, to all those things. And so there's an issue with effort and ownership that goes into it. And I think that's a much bigger picture. I mean, that's a much bigger conversation about sort of ownership and making data freely accessible and open access. But that, I think, is something that can inhibit or prohibit this as well, is that sharing and that sort of like, well, I put a ton of time and effort and funding into this, and how do I ensure that if I put this out there that I'm going to be recognized for it?
Yeah, 100%. This is like, that's a whole other podcast that we could have.
that is a whole other podcast. And that would be a great one. And because I think that is and we can pull this off or whatever you want, but it is a really important thing about equity, and especially about people in like junior scientists earlier in their career, and about folks that want to start a family, because we have a colleague here who does bird research and did this extensive graduate work where it was like super labor intensive, where she collected information from all these nests and all sorts of stuff over like 5 years, and then put her dissertation together, and then her dissertation became public. And then someone came in and scooped all of her data before she was able to publish it. And there's like no, and she doesn't, you don't even get a citation in that sense. You get a note in a table. That's it. That's all you become for all that work that you do. And that's because one, she wasn't fast enough because she was early career. She was thinking about all these other things, trying to get jobs, blah, blah, blah. And she was starting a family. So like, I don't know if you want to talk about the leaky pipe and all that stuff. Like that right there is the current, I think, one of the biggest problems right now. But again, that's a whole other episode that I could,
I mean, it's a big discussion, but I feel like you're touching on something that I really want to know about, which is, okay, well, how did you do it? How did you coordinate all these people? How did you get everyone to collaborate together and share this information in a way that was equitable?
It's the lean back in the chair, staring off into the distance.
Yeah, it's that. No, it's...
I didn't know this was going to be such a big question.
It is a hard question because, like, well, so how do these conversations happen? And I'm trying to think back to, like, when I first had these discussions with my co-authors about what we can do. And honestly... All right, so we're doing plus and minuses of these big expeditions to you know, collect data on. That's partially one of the benefits of those expeditions, is that I was stuck on a boat for 3 weeks with this group of people. And we are talking about our data and like discussing what it means. And then we can start to think of the big picture. So there's, you know, there, that's sort of one of the benefits to, you know, collecting data in the field.
But how did you all end up in the field together?
Because it was, we were trying to maximize, because it is so costly and it's so hard to get to, and the season's very close, we're maximizing the number of different parties that were aboard these vessels. So in the Chagos Archipelago, we had, I can't remember, you know, science teams were probably in the range of like 12 to 15 different people. Some of us were overlapping. Some of us were doing completely different things, from bird surveys to oceanography to, you know, shark stuff. So it's in those conversations. And then when we get together, and part of this was with a consortium, with the Bertarelli Foundation. And when you get together for the symposium and things like that, you have conversations like, oh, what did you see? How was it? You know, what kind of data did you come up with? And say, well, actually, you know, do you have any interest in this? And so part of it is, when you spend so much time with your data, you start to wonder what else you can do with it. And you start to notice things like, oh man, the shark swam along the reef for a long time. Wonder if that's interesting to anybody. And if you know those people, it's an easy sort of next step. So I'd been on the boat with these people, so it was an easy next step. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to always know who to talk to, like, and know what's interesting from those video. I mean, there might be something that has to do with like the light levels that were hitting the reef at different depths that someone else might be able to look at, you know, levels of productivity in the water column. But that's not something I would be able to see. I wouldn't know that this is valuable for it. So there definitely are limitations to sort of the strategy I use to create this community.
So it sounds like all of you were like trying to charter the same organization, or you were all funded by the same person. And that's how, I feel like I'm not quite understanding how all of you ended up in this same spot.
Yeah. Okay. Let me back this up. So, and this is for the work in the Chagos Archipelago, which was a big project that was funded by the Bertarelli Foundation. And they were instrumental in a big marine program to understand this big, beautiful marine protected area. It's part of the British Indian Ocean Territory. It was the largest marine protected area. I think it's 450,000 square kilometers. And so there was a consortium of different universities and NGOs and things like that were doing work there that were funded by the foundation. So that's how we were all there at the same time, with a bunch of different expertise and focuses.
Okay, got it. Thank you. I feel like for me, like, my field site is literally my backyard. So when I think about these really remote locations, I'm like, how do people even get there? How did all these different disciplines coordinate that together?
Yeah.
So that makes a lot more sense. And then,
right, but that's a whole other, you know, thing to tackle. So now you don't just have to tackle getting you there in your logistics of time and resources. Now you've got a team of 15 other PIs that want to go out, and they have limitations on their time. And, you know, then there's like, it's seriously wrangling cats at that moment to organize these. So I was the lead scientist on a number of these expeditions, and it is a non-trivial thing. So, I mean, I probably have so many gray hairs from organizing these things. I could tell stories for hours and hours and hours about chartering fast boats from different islands because we couldn't get lithium batteries across the oceans and things like that. I mean, there's all sorts of considerations that go into these big oceanographic expeditions as well. So put that in the models column.
I feel like we need a separate episode that's just your field stories.
I was like, I cannot wait for our field story section. I
feel stories like with Dr. Taylor Chappell, and also we drink while we listen.
Wait, yes, we should just do drinking field
stories. That sounds great. You might get some of the good ones out of me then.
So moving on to these methods, you specifically chose white sharks and gray reef sharks for this project. Why did you choose these two species, and also why did you choose the two locations that you filmed them in?
So we've been putting biologgers and cameras on animals for a long time. I think I started in 2012 and 2013, and some of my co-authors were the ones that actually developed these tags initially and still design them now. And the reason that we went with the white sharks and with the reef sharks is because they presented two very different sets of challenges in terms of the logistical challenges of, you know, either a long distance expedition and deep reefs, in the case of the reef sharks, and then the danger of the animals themselves in, you know, the habitats in South Africa. And is the second part of it is that they're very different systems where you've got, you know, how do we use these animals to understand a reef habitat versus a benthic kelp forest habitat? And those are things that are in steep decline in so many places. And so they really, these different species in these different areas really hit at a number of critical questions that I think that are facing us right now. So if we could show that these methods were usable and beneficial in these critical habitats, that they would sort of lend more credence to, like, hey, people, let's use our data for something else besides what we meant it to be used for.
That makes sense. And then you use tags called customized animal tracking solutions, also known as CATS camera tags. Can you tell us more about this tag? Because, you know, we say tags. We just had Haley Dalton on our podcast who uses very different tags that she fabricated on her own. So what does your tags look like? How did you acquire those and what are they capturing?
Yeah, the fun part is that not too far ago, Haley and I and our teams had sort of Frankensteined our different texts together, which was a whole different and fun saga. But so the CATS tags, CATS is a company that was started by Nico Liebsch and Peter Kraft. And these biologger tags are actually part of Nico's dissertation. And so they started this company after that to be able to manufacture them because at the time, biologging tags weren't a thing. So, you know, the tags that Nico makes, they've got accelerometers and gyroscopes and magnetometers and depth and pressure, all these components that allow us to look at the fine scale movements and behaviors of animals. And what's super cool about CATS is that they're sort of like the MacGyver of tag development. And hopefully everyone that's listening to this knows MacGyver. If you don't, you should definitely go back because MacGyver's awesome. And the idea that, like, if you have a problem, there's a solution. You just have to figure out what it is. And so the work that we're doing with the white sharks in 2013, we're on the very forefront of that. I think a lot of the techniques that are ubiquitous in the fields now with clamping tags onto shark fins and things like that were spearheaded by CATS. And so they're really able to adapt to whatever situation, whatever question you have. And so that's what we've been doing for the last, you know, 10 or however many, it's been a good decade now, since we first started, or since I first started with Nico and Peter there. And it's great because you can answer a question. I mean, I've got pieces and parts of different ones sitting on my desk. I have the tags we put out with Haley sitting on my desk right now because we've adapted those to answer a question about basking sharks that could pair onto the work that she did. So that's what's really unique and cool about what CATS is able to do.
So speaking of these tags,
right?
Oh my gosh,
it's right there.
Ooh, back on the screen. Put it up to the screen again. I'm gonna take a screenshot.
Okay, look pretty.
Look pretty by getting out of the photo.
Yes, seriously.
So cool. So while we're talking about these tags, what was the process of putting these on these two very dramatically different species in these also equally very dramatically different environments?
Part of what I love about the science that we do is the problem solving. And so getting these tags on animals was like, this is a cool problem. How do we solve that? And Adrian Gleiss, who's a collaborator who's down at Murdoch, and actually Nico and other folks from their lab in grad school had developed this clamp technique to put a biologger on to the fins of whale sharks. And so we knew that fundamentally the idea worked to clamp something on, but we didn't know how it was going to go on. We didn't know how long it was going to stay. We didn't know how much pressure it needed. So you've got this dorsal fin that's relatively rigid for, say, a white shark. How do you get a shark close enough to get that thing on? And then how do you get it to stay on? And so we ended up doing a bunch of different fabrication stuff. And I've got these great pictures of us in 2013 in South Africa with like a table full of stuff. And it was like sandpapers and plastics and epoxies and metals and like everything you could think of. And we're like, all right, we've got to figure this out. And we went out the first day and the first tag that we put on came off in like 2 hours. The shark accelerated and it came right off. And we're like, all right, well, it's not strong enough. We need to make the spring stronger on this one. And then we went out and the next one just worked perfect. It was amazing. So the process really was like, all right, how do we get access to these animals? And so for the white shark is, well, we know we can get them relatively close to the boat. But how do we clamp this on? Are we doing it by hand? So we had these like hand attachment things. We had a rigid pole that it could only go at one angle. So Oliver Jewell, who was helping us at the time, who ended up doing all his PhD on this work because he was so instrumental, was able to like basically coax the sharks in just the right angle so that when the shark came by, it was the right distance away and it was going in the right direction so that you could clamp this thing on as it swam off. So it was.
How fast are they moving?
It depends. And this is what like, this is what it really shows the how impressive the team is, because you've got, right, it's not like I wrote this paper and said, well, I did all this work by myself. It means that I was just the one who happened to write it up, and that there's 15 other people that were instrumental to this work. And so, you know, these sharks are, they can move super fast, but part of it, they can also move relatively slow if you work them in a certain way. And so that was what Ollie was, and probably still is, incredibly good at, reading the sharks and be able to bring them in a certain way, bait coming in not too fast, not too slow, the right amount of chum, that type of thing. So you get them in the right sort of mindset and you bring them to the right place. And so, and at that same time, I've got to be in place along the water to do that. We have to have the tag on the pole and everything has to be firing at the right time. All the pieces and parts are there. And then it goes out. And that's half of it, right? It doesn't matter if you put that out. If that tag doesn't come off, and if it doesn't come off a place you can find, and doesn't come off a place you can find it, you can actually get it, you get nothing. Like, you get zero. You get a bill for $10,000, basically, for what that tag costs.
What?
So
because you have to find the tag to download the data.
You have to find the tag to download it, because we're talking gigabytes of data. And so you have to get that back. So all of this is for naught if you don't go and find that tag. So if there's any piece or part of that, execution to get it out there, and the execution for it to pop up and for it to communicate to the satellites and for you to be able to find it, like any part of those breaks down, you lose it and you get absolutely nothing out of all of that effort. So it's not trivial.
Stressful.
It is stressful, but it's so awesomely rewarding when it works. And
yeah,
that's the part of it, right? That's like this, that's why we do this. And that's why being able to use those data for something else is so important. So we went through all that stress, right? We went through all those nights of like trying to figure out how this was going to work, trying to figure out how we were going to, you know, support and fund this project to go, and who the team needed to be, and how we like worked out the different skill sets that come to make this work. So now we get it. We get these data back and we're like, oh, cool. We got a shark swimming in the water. We can tell you how many tails times it beat its tail. It's like, is that it? Is that all we want to do with it? No, right? There's so many other things that can come out of that. And so that was the whole point of this paper, to say, look, we're doing all this work. There's all these resources going out, not to mention the animals that we were, you know, disrupting their normal life. We should be utilizing that, right? We should be utilizing that to the most effect that we can. And so that's where all this came out of.
I'm just thinking like, what could go wrong when you have all these moving parts and then you get through what you might think is the end of it and it's not, and you like, you're only really a quarter of the way there if you get it on there, because what if it doesn't work? Yeah. Like you said, what if you never get the tag back? And I think, like, as someone who does not use the type of tags that I have to, like, go out and retrieve, it's hard to grasp the concept of how large the ocean is and how, like, needle in a haystack it is to get these giant packages back.
Yeah, you know, it makes me think of, it was my first field season as a grad student, and I was charged with putting out these satellite tags, so pop-off satellite tags on sharks, and they're, you know, they're about, whatever, $4,000 at the time, which is a lot of money. And as a grad student, like, that's a crazy amount of money. And I don't remember what happened, but I had to call my supervisor or a collaborator at the time, Barb Block, and say, "Hey, Barb, I don't know. I don't know if it went right. Like, I'm worried about it, blah, blah." And she stopped me there and she was like, "Listen, don't ever put something in the ocean you expect to get back." She's like, "We put it out there hoping that we get data back, that something phenomenal happens from that. But there's a pretty good chance that it won't. So set that as your expectation and be really excited if you do." So I think that's kind of the way that we've had to look at these different, you know, expeditions, or almost like adventures, is that you have to look at it as, like, a lot of times you're trying something that nobody's tried before. And, you know, there's the cliche that nobody's tried it before because it's so hard. And that really is the truth. Like, if it was easy, somebody else would have already done it. And so putting these camera tags on, you know, we really were the first ones to do this in 2013 to sort of, you know, spearhead this, these techniques. And it was like touch and go at times, but ultimately, like, the amount of data that have been collected from these is incredible. And the amount of things that we can do with it's pretty incredible. So it's worth it. It's worth those sort of, like, tear your hair out moments when things don't pop up. Those times when you go out and you find that tag and you realize that you misread the sequence of LEDs and you actually didn't turn it on. Or the time where you think you lost a tag forever because you never heard from it, and some guy in Oregon calls you and said, "Hey, I found this on the beach." And you say, "Okay, cool." And then you look at the tag number and realize the one that you were searching for on this from the satellites was not the one that you put out. So you wrote it wrong in your book. So there's all those things that happen, but it makes all of those things worth it.
This is so validating, I have to say.
Yes, 100% validating.
What Amani doesn't know and what other listeners don't know is that I literally called Dr. Chappell while I was on a boat about a month ago because I was putting acoustic tags and soup fins, and I thought I turned it on. I thought it was going to be obvious how it turned on, and we had this animal, like, with an opening in its cloacal cavity, and I put the tag in and I sutured it up and it swam away, and I called Dr. Chappell and I was like, "Please tell me that I turned that on correctly." So that the animal swimming away right now isn't dead.
That's amazing.
No, and it's not, you know, they happen everywhere. Like, they, you know, the camera tags, like, one of them, we rigged the zip ties wrong. And so that if it had gone out, it never actually would have popped up. And it wasn't until, like, we missed a bunch of opportunities. We're all like, "Oh, this stinks. Like, we really wish we could have got that out." And we were just kind of sitting there on the boat. And then we're like, "Oh, wait a second. This one's rigged wrong. If we'd gotten it out, it never would have popped up. We never would have heard from it again." You know, it's like those things happen all the time. We try to limit them, but it's the truth, right? And, like, in that moment, as Megan, as you know, it's like, you almost get those blinders on, and you have to have, like, a good team with you, or you have to be really well prepared in order to, like, move through those steps in those moments. Because it's high stakes, right? You've got an animal there, and you've also, like, put a ton of time and effort into making that moment exist. So you want to make sure that you maximize it.
A very good lesson in not becoming complacent when you think you know all of your methods, down to the point that you could do it in your sleep, because that's when you start making mistakes that you're like, "How could I have done that?"
Yeah, for sure. There's so much that comes down to being methodical, but also questioning yourself and say, "All right, do I have this set? Have I done this right? Let's double check this. Let's triple check this. And on the other side of it, it's also like the realistic part is that like we all screw up at times and we all leave the magnet on the Vemco tag, which Megan did not do, by the way. But it happens. Like you see a tag shark swim away or something and it still has this little piece of tape on it. You're like, weird, what's that piece of tape? And you're like, right, that's the one holding the magnet on that turns it on. So, oops. You know, there it happens.
Okay, so I feel like this is a good segue into you got all these videos, you put these tags out on two very different animals and two very different habitats. So let's talk about what you actually found from that. From the white shark videos, you were able to capture the abundance of individual kelp thalli. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Along transects. So like individual organisms of kelp. You were able to find the percentage of coverage of broad-scale underlying habitat types and the relative density and location of giant kelp. And then you were also able to look at coral density and fish density with the reef shark videos. So can you expand on that a little bit more? Like what was useful about that information? Are there other publications that might come out of being able to gather that information? What do you think?
I think a lot.
What do you think?
I think a lot. I'm going to start saying that in my normal conversations.
All right, now I get what your question was, Megan. So with both of these techniques, the idea was to make the data that we collected make it fall into the same frameworks that are collected in standard surveys. So standard diver surveys, you're going down and you're looking at what biomass is, or you're looking at what bleaching is happening, or you're looking at fish assemblages and things. And those are really standard methods to assess the health of reefs, the effects of like different anthropogenic effects, whatever it is that those are metrics that are used universally around the world to understand the health of these marine systems. And so the goal of this was, we weren't trying to say, hey, this is the health of the system here and we need to go, and protect these habitats or do this. That may come out of it, but the real purpose of this was to say that, hey, we know that these methods of data collection or these data are really important to, how we monitor marine systems and how we protect different areas and things like that. But we have a different way that maybe you could be collecting them or you could add into your data sets. And so, again, we weren't trying to nail home a message that said, that those mesophotic reef systems were actually doing really well after these bleaching events compared to the shallower shelf, which we did find that. But it was to say that, hey, actually, this is a method that you could use to collect some of those data. And it was cool because for the most part, especially in the kelp forest, is that the data that we collected were very similar to those that had been collected in diver surveys, a decade before and a few decades before. So it really showed that they were comparable. And again, that was the real impetus of this to say that, hey, this is a viable method. And in the reef system, while a few of the metrics were similar, some of them weren't. And that also goes to show, where are we missing something? And you think about, as I mentioned before, is that, we jump into the water and then we're this sort of like alien being floating through the water, as opposed to a shark that's sort of in that natural system. And so you would expect to be some differences about what the shark is going to see and what we're going to see, because animals are going to run away from us more likely than they are to, I mean, it sounds crazy, but they're not just going to swim away every time they see a shark. Ultimately, what it was to look and say that, hey, we've figured out a way that maybe we can add to your data set. Maybe we can add value to ours in this collaborative process.
This is so funny because you just, like, I know you think you're just spewing things, but you're answering questions that we're going to ask you as you're spewing things. And so Megan and I...
It's a good sign or a bad sign is y'all are used to asking questions of spew questions and or that I'm spewing something intelligible.
It's perfect. I don't know. So in your conclusion, you mentioned that the data from a range of animal-borne cameras will be collected alongside standard survey techniques for each animal group so that the approach can be adapted and rigorously calibrated. Do you think this is completely feasible given that some of these areas and places are standard techniques, examples like diving surveys?
Yeah, I do think that they are. I do think it's realistic that we can use comparative simultaneous analyses to sort of ground truth the utility of these different methods. It doesn't take that much to put these, you know, put cameras out on animals, and there's cameras going out on animals all over the place, you know, and whether it's turtles or birds or it's fish or sharks or whatever it is, things are getting smaller, things are getting cheaper. And so just the sheer volume of data for marine systems that are becoming available is incredible. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for simultaneous data being taken sort of on accident, sort of like what we did. It's like we did the reef surveys, the diver surveys that were done a few years before this paper came out, weren't done expecting that we were going to do a shark reef survey. But it just happened to be that those were done in very similar places in a very sort of similar time period. So as more data become available, that's going to happen more often. And also the idea that these technologies are becoming cheaper and much easier and smaller is that you can pair that on, right? So you're going to do a survey. It doesn't take that much to drop a system in on some animals in that environment to collect some data. You can set it up. We didn't, and the data still became or were still comparable and valuable. But you could easily design a system or an instance where you're actually purposely putting those out.
Okay, well, that's my perfect lead to my last question, which is like, why aren't more people using this, and how do we get this into more frequent use? Because I'm sold on this technique. I have friends that study mesophotic reefs, and I've already been texting them like, okay, so we're going to collaborate on some shark reef experiments. So that's happening.
I think that the more that folks that are collecting these video data are thinking about the additional uses outside of their intended use, but the additional use of these data is what's going to drive this. I'm not sure you're going to find a mesophotic reef expert that's going to start calling me up and be like, hey, do you happen to have a shark video from, you know, this reef in this random place? And they'd be like, well, no. But I think you could go the other way and say that, all right, we have these data from here. How can they be useful? And so, you know, there have been other papers that have come out looking at other uses of camera tag data. And I think that as the body of literature start to build, I think it becomes more apparent to folks that there is additional value. And that really was the purpose. So we're not the first people to say that you can collect other stuff from video data. I mean, there were papers back in the early 2000s that noted some things, but our goal was to be like, all right, well, is it comparable? And how do we sort of elevate this use to the broader community? So I think the more papers and the more folks that do it, the more that gets into sort of the general thought process is how this gets bigger. I think this podcast is going to do it.
Hopefully.
So, Dr. Chappell, that was super interesting and really helpful, I think, to our listeners. We are at the favorite part of our podcast. I feel like we got some bonus content earlier. But what is your favorite field story? It doesn't have to be from this field work. It can be from any time. Do you have a favorite field story being out in the field?
I've got a ton of favorite field stories, but I'll give a quick one, which is maybe not the funniest of the favorite field stories. But so I think I'm going to go with like the coolest one I'd ever experienced. And I was doing some work down in the Galapagos. We were tagging hammerheads and Galapagos sharks. And I was on this dive, and when you fly into Galapagos, it's like desert. It's like being in like Baja, Mexico. I'd done a bunch of field work and I was like, all right, I don't know what the big hype is. It looks like a kind of like a desert. And then we got in the water and it was this like, you know, this really rich kind of like California current style water. And in that water were flightless cormorants, were penguins, and were sea turtles. So all those things, like, and I'm just free dive. I'm literally like 5 feet away from all of that stuff happening right in front of my face. And I remember just having this moment of being like, holy, this is all the stuff that I've like read about forever as an undergrad. And this is stuff that like, this is magical. Like you don't get these three crazy things all in the same place at the same time. So that for me was one of the most like mind-bending moments of field work, of just like really appreciating that like I am in a crazy, crazy world and it is cool.
Amazing. So where can our listeners find you? Where can they keep up with your work?
They can keep up with us. We are on Instagram at Big Fish Lab, or come to our website, Oregon State, and come to Big Fish Lab and learn about. There's tons of cool stuff with physiology and behavior and movement and an incredible group of people that make all this work happen. So people are welcome to visit us, call us anytime. We're always excited to talk about sharks.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was a lot of fun, as I'm sure people got from the constant laughing throughout this entire episode.
Yeah, this thank you so much.
Hopefully I, you know, will get invited back again. I do know Alex McInturf, so if that's what gets me in the door, then that's
cool. That's his real claim to fame.
Alex's boss.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Chappell, and thank you, Sharkies, for being here listening and learning with us. And until next time,
swim you later.
Really? Swim you later?